Good morning. This is now the 30th of October and time for the Halloween edition of Uncle Don Reads the Comics. This is CFUR Radio, campus-based community radio in Prince George at 88.7 FM. Today's show is sponsored by the Central Intelligence Agency, proudly overthrowing Fidel Castro since 1959. First, an organization whose time has come. This is a serious item, trust me. There are some people in town who want to organize a Prince George humanist organization. Humanists are folks who believe there is no divine being looking after our welfare and that we humans are responsible for our own destiny. We're looking for members who want to raise their voices against the fundamentalist nonsense that is growing around us. If you would be interested in joining us, drop a line to Uncle Don, care CFUR Radio, 3333 University Way, Prince George, B.C., V2N4Z9. Of course, dissenting letters are also welcome. The usual caveat applies. Any letters may be subject to criticism and ridicule on the air. A Martha Stewart Halloween. Out where we live, we've not had a Halloween panhandler at our door for 16 years. Now the children of the kids who never came to our door are not coming to the same door. A tradition has begun. I don't know whether our home has been neglected because of our remoteness, the nearest neighbor being a kilometer away, or because of the dogs. Most of the wee ghosts and goblins are too small to read the Achtung Meinen signs, and any fool can find a way through the barbed wire. But we have three large dogs, and we always wear masks when we discipline them. According to Martha Stewart, traditional Halloween tricks in treats are out. The kids are wise to the razor blades and the apples, and some parents have been cheating by having their kids loot X-rayed. X-lax is an old trick, and everyone recognizes those morsels. In this new century, the kiddies really appreciate homemade treats. Martha suggests the following. Take sheets of colored cellophane and cut them into 15-centimeter squares. Yes, centimeters. This is the 21st century, so leave the medieval measurements behind. Now, where was I? Ah, yes. Squares of cellophane. Now, go to your medicine cabinet and clear out all of those stale, dated medications that have been accumulating. Mix them all up thoroughly and put a half dozen in the center of each square of cellophane. Pull the corners together and tie a colored ribbon of contrasting color around the neck. Voila! Instant Halloween treat. Always make sure that the uppers and downers are thoroughly mixed and put aside some of the Viagra in special treat packs for the bigger boys as a special surprise. And a happy Halloween to all. And now, smoking is good for you. The Czech Republic has now received a study of the effects of smoking on government expenses and revenues. This study was prepared by Arthur D. Little International and paid for by Philip Morris to make sure the study was unbiased. Guess what they discovered? Smoking saves the Czech government vast amounts of money. According to a report in the Yellow Times, this study revealed that the 22,000 smoking-related deaths in the Czech Republic earned the Czech economy $27 million in 1999. Each smoking-related death saved the government $1,227. On the plus side of smoking, there were customs duties, value-added taxes, excise taxes, corporate income taxes, and savings like pensions, health care, and housing not needed by seniors who die prematurely due to tobacco. Now, if I may be permitted to superimpose this study onto the scene in Canada, I might be forgiven for deducing that smoking will soon be made mandatory for all of our citizens. How else could I explain the figures on hospital beds released by the Canadian Institute for Health Information and Statistics Canada? These organizations tell us that between 1984 and now, the number of hospitals in Canada has declined from 1,233 to 753, and the number of beds declined from 177,008 to 117,102. Since hospital beds have declined by a third, we can assume that the government expects a third of our 30 million citizens to die soon. Well, with 10 million fewer citizens, the problem of affordable housing should be solved. Count your blessings as you light that next cigarette. If I had kept smoking, I could have died by now and freed up pension costs and the housing that my wife and I are wasting while young smokers need a roof over their heads. If I were altruistic, I should take up the habit again. Roommates. Over the years, I've had some obnoxious roommates at the various schools I have attended, but I was never so overcome with anger that I stabbed one. I threatened much worse, but I never followed through on those threats. My experiences led me to an interesting conclusion. I've maintained friendships with a larger proportion of former roommates than any people with whom I have associated in other ways. I have an active correspondence with three men with whom I was thrust against my will into close quarters in schools. The longest of these relationships goes back 45 years and the most recent for 39. Friends from work, old lovers, and others have come and gone in my life, but none have the tenacity of old roommates. Be kind to your roommates. They may one day be your best friends. One university roommate was thrust together with me in an old dormitory in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. No love was lost between us, though, as we had been put into a room that had formerly been a single, but into which the administration saw fit to cram two bodies. Two each of beds, dressers, desks, and chairs filled the room. A small closet held all of our clothes and odd junk. Like two rats in a cage too small, we fought, but like sophisticated gentlemen. We used trickery, sabotage, and elaborate setups to get at one another. This roommate, who transferred into the university from another after 2 years of straight A's, studied hard but in a peculiar manner. He enjoyed listening to his radio while sipping vodka and eating ancient popcorn purchased in huge plastic bags. One night he overdid the vodka part and puked in his bed. In the morning he awoke, declared that the residue was disgusting, and departed for the day, leaving me to deal with it while I worked on an urgent project at my desk. Lovely. I plotted revenge. While studying and getting pissed on his vodka, the roommate, I will call John because that was his name, kept time with the radio music and went through wild gyrations. He fancies himself a very cool dude. Catching him at a vulnerable moment, I said, "You're real cool, John. They should call you El Culo." It worked. I played him like Pavlov's dogs until he was trained to respond to, "Who are you, John?" with, "I'm El Culo." Now he was ready for the kill. I maneuvered him up to the room of a fellow of our acquaintance who was from Cuba. I primed him. "Tell him who you are, John." "I'm El Culo," responded John, like a good stooge. As the Cuban fell to the floor in a fit of laughter, John suddenly realized he had been had. El Culo in Spanish means the asshole. Several years later, John had earned himself an MBA from Wharton, and he was on a steep upward career path. He was working for a New York brokerage that was training him by sending him around the states to its various branches. Finally, they sent him to San Francisco. I was then working for an electrical wholesaler in Oakland, just across the bay from San Francisco, and I was leading a California lifestyle. I persuaded John to stay at my place and commute to San Francisco. I met John at the San Francisco airport. He came off the plane in his three-piece suit, swinging his briefcase. Immaculately coiffed and manicured, he cringed when he saw me. I had put on my finest pair of rainbow-striped bell-bottoms and other suitable paraphernalia. I escorted him out to my car, the inevitable Volkswagen Bug, decorated with huge daisies. We chatted while on the way to Oakland, and I told him glowingly how easy it was to live there cheaply once you learned to cut corners and conserve. My home had cost only $35 a month, that is, it had been condemned, and the furniture was mostly cast-offs. As another example, I pointed out that the toll booths on the bridge we were approaching could be navigated at such a speed that one's presence was not noted. I booted it, as best I could in a Volkswagen Bug, and shot through the booths at about 60 miles an hour. John freaked. He kept looking back for flashing lights indicating pursuit. It was several days before he realized that those booths had been closed in favor of collecting double tolls just one way in the other direction. After arriving at my home, I got John to put on his most casual clothes, and I dragged him back to San Francisco, where I'd been invited to a party at the Rip Off Press, an outfit that printed the number of the popular comics of the era. There we joined with a large bunch of the staff, bona fide hippies, and hangers-on. John's casual clothes consisted of a pair of slacks, loafers, and a sweater that made him look like he was going to an Ivy League fraternity party. As soon as he walked in the door, the place became quiet, and you could see everyone with a thought bubble over his head reading, "Cop." Well, things soon loosened up and the party resumed. John unwound as he filled up on the keg beer and the odd joint that was passing around. He was about to take a healthy slug from a gallon jug of wine when a hippie warned him, "Watch out for the wine, man. There's acid in it." The evening ended quietly, and I subsequently wondered what might have transpired if John had taken a healthy hit on that wine. John and I still correspond by email and snail mail. He now lives in New York with his Chinese wife, but that's another story. His snail mail recently has been heavy with clippings from the New York Times. Lots of ammunition there for Uncle Don. Let's see. There's one clipping reporting how the American military, under the guise of fighting terrorism in Colombia, is training the Colombian army in methods to protect a vital oil pipeline. That's the way to defend freedom. And a short item about how the Pentagon conducted germ warfare tests in Alaska, Hawaii, Maryland, California, Utah, and Florida. I wonder if the Florida tests affected thought processes. Big deal, right? Well, the article says there was also a test of Bacillus globigi, described as being in the family of anthrax in, quote, southwestern Canada in 1965. That's us. Welcome to the New World Order. Also, the U.S. is pushing for total exemption for its citizens from prosecution by the International Criminal Court. It seems they are afraid for some of their more prominent citizens, like Henry Kissinger. Well, folks, if you don't want to be prosecuted by any court, try not breaking the laws. That goes for international laws, too. The best story that John sent is about the inventor who mounted a rifle scope onto a common laser pointer and used the gadget to blind those ubiquitous television cameras that watch us in public places. These things can blind cameras at a couple of hundred meters. Of course, if they are not now illegal, they soon will be, in the interests of fighting terrorism, no doubt. Kyoto plans. It's refreshing to see that the federal government of Canada realizes that the world faces a crisis in climate change. About time. Troglodytes like Ralph Klein will be dragged kicking and screaming toward any solution that costs his business friends money, and he can probably be handled. There are many things that we can all do to reduce our impact on the environment. For one thing, we can force the automakers to make more fuel-efficient vehicles, and we can raise taxes on hydrocarbon fuels to reduce their use. I cannot see why gasoline, a non-renewable resource, is cheaper than milk. What I don't understand is our government's stand that it should get credits for exporting clean energy in the form of natural gas and electricity to the United States. Supposedly, this will offset their use of dirty fuels. Since the United States has rejected Kyoto, we should assume that our cleaner energy exports will be used in addition to their dirty alternatives. Instead of asking for credits, we should count the gases produced by exported fuels as our pollution and cut it accordingly. If the United States does not like our cutting oil, gas, and electricity, then they can trim their consumption. My heart would not bleed if Californians could not heat their swimming pools with Canadian energy. Canada should also put a carbon tax on all imports from the United States and other countries that do not meet the Kyoto quotas. The money brought in by this tax could help offset costs of our industries in meeting their own obligations. The Washington sniper finally found. They finally got their man. Justice triumphs. God bless America. I mean, look at all of the people who were protected by God and who were not shot. When I heard an official from the Washington area on the radio last Friday morning, I could not contain myself. His evaluation of the outcome of this little drama was, and I quote, "Faith and hope always triumph over darkness and despair." Doesn't that just make you tingle all over? And then there's the important stuff. While we've been wasting our collective time worrying about the coming war on Iraq, terrorism, class grades, inflation, and getting lucky, there have been important things going on in the world that we have missed. For instance, many of us may have missed the news that there has been a new record set in Thailand for living with scorpions. Some woman has spent 32 days living in a glass box in a department store in Pattaya, Thailand. She shared her 12-meter square accommodation with 3,400 scorpions. No honorable mention was given to the soul who counted those scorpions, but Ms. Unpronounceable now holds the quote, unofficial world record for the longest stay in a room full of venomous scorpions. You heard it first from Uncle Don. This is Uncle Don with Uncle Don Reads the Comics on CFUR 88.7 FM in Prince George. This is Radio Free Prince George. A tribute to Comrade Arkhipov. 40 years ago, the world stood on the brink of nuclear war. John F. Kennedy, the man admired by many Americans, second only to Elvis Presley, had drawn a line in the sand, as they say in the war biz, as a result of learning that the Russians were installing nuclear missiles in Cuba. Although American missiles were in a tight ring around the Soviet Union, including some just a few kilometers from their border in Turkey, Kennedy had declared that the Soviets had no reciprocal right, and he was ready to take the world into the hell of nuclear war over the issue. I was working in New York City at this time, and I can tell you the world was scared. No one who lived through those days will ever forget them. There has just been a conference in Havana, organized by the U.S. National Security Archive and the government of Cuba on the occasion of that 40th anniversary. It brought together officials of the Cuban government, notably Fidel Castro, with former Soviet generals and surviving members of Kennedy's administration. This was billed as a conference of remembrance and reconciliation. The participants exchanged stories on the parts they played in the drama that finally saw Khrushchev back down and take the sane route of removing the offending missiles. If he had been as willing as Kennedy to force the issue, we would have been into World War III. Which brings us to Comrade Arkhipov. One of the anecdotes coming out of that conference was the following. On the 27th of October, one of three Soviet B-59 submarines off the shore of Cuba was being forced to the surface by depth charges fired by an American destroyer. As the depth charges pounded the submarine, Soviet sailors were screaming for their officers to sink the American ship that was threatening to kill them. Unbeknownst to the Americans, each of these submarines had one nuclear-tipped torpedo. This torpedo could be fired only with the unanimous consent of three key officers on board. Two voted to fire. Arkhipov voted no. At this Havana conference, former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara affirmed that a nuclear attack on a U.S. ship could easily have escalated into a full-scale exchange leading to a total nuclear war. How many times in history has the planet been saved from total destruction by nuclear war? Can we prevent it again? And could George Bush's crusade, his term, against the Islamic world lead to nuclear war? The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty obliges the signatories to work actively to dismantle their nuclear arsenals. This portion of the treaty has been ignored by the nuclear powers. We cannot always count on a hidden hero like Comrade Arkhipov to save us from the follies of our egomaniac leaders. Brand loyalty. I sometimes wonder how many people I see wearing the corporate ads on their clothing really have any loyalty to those brands. Does the woman wearing the Guess Jeans t-shirt really like that brand, or was the shirt a gift from her demented grandmother? Does the clown in the sweatshirt with Budweiser in huge letters from one arm to the other really drink that stuff? And does the world give a damn that your truck is a 4x4? Can you do the math? You will see my truck in the parking lot occasionally. I have the answer because I had math in elementary school. Mine is the truck with the answer. 4x4=16. But I digress. I want to tell you again of my legendary brother in North Carolina. Brother has more money than God, but he is severely frugal. And evidence of his frugality is the obvious fact that he will not throw away clothing until it is no longer suitable for rags. His jeans have holes, his shirts are washed out, and I've counted the toes protruding from his runners. Which brings me to a tale of brand loyalty. Brother John had a pair of runners that he wore constantly for years. He bragged about the durability of his Nikes and often sang their praises. He showed them proudly to me on one of my visits, and I was impressed with their durability. One sad day they wore through, tops and bottoms, and John had to face the prospect of replacing them. He reluctantly darkened the door of a store that sold new clothing, specifically footwear. He told the clerk that he wanted a pair of shoes exactly like the ones that had served him so well. The clerk apologized, saying that he regretted that his store was a Nike store and did not sell Reeboks like John's. What can I say? Patriotism run amok. This was the expression used by Dan Rather, the American television journalist, when referring to the mood following the stunts of 11 September 2001. The press, along with the rest of the population of the United States, was afraid of being accused of being unpatriotic. Flags were everywhere. People were compelled to wear them on their clothes, fly them on their homes, stick them on their cars. We could see that up here with the American tourists. Here in Prince George, I came across a Jeep with Yankee plates and a huge flag on its grill, blocking the air that was supposed to cool the engine. Better to overheat the engine than to be thought unpatriotic, even by Canadians. I write this as I recover from my own overheating. My stepdaughter's lover showed up lately in a sweatshirt emblazoned with USA in huge letters. The only thing worse than an American patriot is a wannabe American patriot who lacks only the citizenship. No, maybe there is something worse. Someone who is so unaware of the state of the world that he would wear such a thing without knowing what it represents. Which reminds me, of course, of a story from the distant past. 1986, to be specific. When Woody, my wife, and I traveled to Nicaragua to see what the Sandinista Revolution was all about, there was a young black man on the plane with us from El Salvador to Managua wearing a red, white, and blue tracksuit with USA across the chest. We marveled that an American could be so insensitive as to travel to Nicaragua in such an outfit while the country was engaged in a war for its survival with that same USA. In Managua, we went our separate ways, only to meet this fellow again 2 weeks later at the airport while we were waiting to leave. This time he was wearing normal street clothes while we were wearing bicycling shirts with Nicaragua across the chest. Our man came over to us and asked where we had purchased the shirts, and we told him. He said, "I come from this country and I've never found such a shirt." The clown was a Nicaraguan. It took us a long time to adjust to that one. It seems that the Nicaraguans were able to fight a war against the United States while holding no grudge against the country in general. The United States does not fight its wars this way. It has to demonize the country, its people, and especially its leader. How many leaders have we seen characterized as another Hitler in the last decade or two? Right now, we have Saddam Hussein as another Hitler. Before him, there was Manuel Noriega, the pathetic president of Panama. They even have used that tag on the poor bugger whose name no one remembers in Grenada. He was going to strangle the American oil supply from his tiny island. Who's next? Back to Dan Rather. He said that the patriotism run amok is in danger of trampling the freedom of American journalists to ask tough questions. In this era, when Son of a Bush has declared that you are either with us or with the terrorists, the journalists feel trapped. Not only are they intimidated, but their real access to real news is more severely limited than ever before. How are they to find out what's going on? Are they to rely on Pentagon press releases? Dan Rather is quoted as saying that there has never been an American war, small or large, in which access has been so limited as this one. And the problem is much deeper than censorship. The self-censorship is probably worse when it inhibits journalists from looking for truth. The truth, when spoken or written, can bring down the wrath of the official propagandists and, worse, the corporations that employ the journalists. Unless a person is of the stature of Dan Rather, with a security of substantial personal means, he or she can be intimidated into following the party line. Based upon what we can pick up from television, radio, and newspapers, we're supposed to make informed judgments of the so-called war on terrorism and the coming war against Iraq. When the news sources are restricted and the journalists intimidated into being conduits for the official government line, how are we to come to rational conclusions? That question is not entirely rhetorical. We still have access to intelligent, informed, dissenting views, but it takes work to find them. At UNBC, we are fortunate to have the Prince George Public Interest Research Group that holds a library of alternative publications available to the public. Check out their resources and talk to the volunteers and staff there if you want to get a different view on what is being done in our name. Remember, this is not just an American war that is brewing. Krychin has pledged our support if Bush can get a semblance of acquiescence from the UN Security Council. Right now, Bush and his regime are twisting arms and offering bribes to get that Security Council support. Door prizes. Last week I told you I'd be awarding door prizes this week. The best laid plans and all that. No door prizes this week. Maybe next. I lied. Live with it. The American Empire and the War on Terrorism again. I'm not the person to look for an unbiased view of the American Empire and their New World Order. As a third-rate political refugee from the United States, I have strong opinions. By third-rate political refugee, I mean I came here out of political conviction, but not in fear for my life or safety. I was able to sort out my affairs, tie up loose ends, and drive here with my personal possessions unmolested by officials as I left the United States. The only overt sign of my feelings at that time, my border crossing, was a bumper sticker on my car that I had bought from a right-wing super patriot group. It read, "America, love it or leave it." What I consider a first-tier political refugee is one who came here to escape persecution or worse. At the time I came up, there were others arriving from the States who were coming in fear. In Toronto, I met a man who had literally run across the border with the U.S. federal police on his heels. His only crime was that he quit his job. His job was as a soldier. I know well that the U.S. considers its soldiers to be government property. Maybe in the all-new, all-volunteer army it is different, but the draft was a form of term slavery, and slaves are not allowed to revolt. Since the stunts of 11/9/2001 in New York and Washington, I've read a lot of analysis of the situation. The most prolific material is what we see in the daily newspapers and the mass magazines that parrots the government line about evil empires, terrorist plots, and all the rest. Then there's the more critical stuff that you can find in the alternative press and on the internet, which covers the whole spectrum from loony right to loony left. Conspiracy theories are thick on the ground, and I imagine that you have heard the most of them. But the conspiracy theories, even the ones that posit the connivance of the United States government in the attack, serve a purpose for the American empire. They take our eyes off the ball, so to speak. The attacks on the World Trade Center, the Bali bombing, the attack on the French oil tanker, are all sideshows and small potatoes. The main event that we are supposed to ignore is the expansion of the American empire in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union. It is being candidly admitted by those who were the greatest hawks during the Cold War that the Soviet Union was never the expansionist evil empire that we had been led to fear during those years. The policy of containment that was much trumpeted was not actually the containment of communism, but the frustration that hawkish American leaders felt in their ambitions for world domination. It was the Americans who were contained because they had an enemy powerful enough to thwart them in their grosser violations of international law and plans for territorial conquests. Now that the Soviet Union has been dismembered, humiliated, and tamed, there are no serious challengers to American military power. Its weaknesses are in the area of economic control of the world, and the key to that control is the future of oil. The United States knows that by controlling the oil of the world, it controls the lifeblood of the world economy. Why was there a coup in Venezuela to overthrow Chavez? Oil. His government was supplying oil to Cuba, and it supplies enough of the imports to the United States that it could cause them a supply problem. Iraq sits on a huge pool of oil. If it did not, we would not even know the name of Saddam Hussein. How many brutal dictatorships are there in Africa that we could not even find on a map, much less know the name of their leaders? Why don't we know or care? They have no oil. If you think that the United States cares for democracy or human rights in Iraq, I would suggest that you are missing the double dip at the Jolly Time Bingo Hall, and you should go there immediately. Bye-bye. When Bush, senior or junior, take your pick, stands in front of the world and bemoans the danger to world stability of the weapons of mass destruction supposedly possessed by Iraq, the people of the world should laugh him off the stage. There's one nation that possesses a preponderance of the world's weapons of mass terror, and that is the United States. They are the ones who throw their weight around at will and make the world unsafe for sovereign nations and world peace. The United States now has a declared policy that will not tolerate the emergence of any power that could possibly challenge it militarily. This was the essence of the Bush-Lights National Security Strategy of the United States of America, published on 17 September. The U.S. now spends so much of its national effort and treasure to develop weapon systems that no nation or coalition stands a chance of catching up to them. Nor would such an attempt to catch up be tolerated under the new American policy of empire. No empire in the past has lasted as long as it thought it would. The American empire also will succumb before they expect. I believe that we as Canadians should help to bring this empire to its knees. It will not be easy. It will not be comfortable. Empires do not die quietly. This empire can be gradually isolated by the nations of the world. There are already signs of this beginning to happen. Most nations of the world have embraced the Kyoto Accords in the face of American opposition. Similarly, for the International Criminal Court. In actions like these lie the seeds of isolating and collapsing the evil empire that is now the United States of America. Let us hope that Canada has future governments that join in this world effort, and that they do not decide to be quislings to the empire. There is no reason to take Canada down with the American ship of state. Well, that's it for the Halloween edition of Uncle Don Reads the Comics on CFUR Radio 88.7 in Prince George. Don't forget that outside of every silver lining, there is a dark cloud.